Okay, well, the pressure's really on now. I don't even know most of you. And I would like to know most of you. I'd like to know, I thought that was a mistake. I'd like to know all of you. So tonight I'm going to talk about magic, the Hudson River, the fact that I want all of you to like me and think that I'm smart, and how this practice can help one deal with all that, help me and help all of us deal with things like that. So it's also about loving attention, awareness, and small mind. Loving attention, awareness, and small mind. So I want to start with magic. I went to a meditation retreat in England with Ajahn Sumedho. It was a retreat that greatly affected my practice, and I'll share a little bit of some of the things that came to me in that retreat. But I don't remember if it was right before the retreat or after the retreat. I spent about 2 or 3 days in London. I'd never been in London before, and I was by myself. So one night, I checked out what was in the theater district, and there was a stage illusionist who was doing a performance on. I used to be in a magic troupe when I was in high school. I've always had a little interest in stage magic. I was only in it for 1 year. I don't know if I got kicked out or whatever. But I went to this illusionist, and he basically started out by telling us how he does what he does. He showed us how he does what he does, because he could just tell you, and it makes no difference. You're still fooled. So this is how it started. He said, "I'm going to show you a video, okay? And I want you to, in the video, you're going to see these two people playing ping pong, and I want you to keep track of how many times they successfully get the ping pong ball over the net." So he puts the video on, and you see these two people playing ping pong, and you count, and you count, and you count. He turns the video off, and then you assume he's going to ask, you know, how many times did it go over the net? Which I thought I knew anyways. And he said, "How many of you saw the gorilla walk on stage behind the ping pong table?" And I didn't see the gorilla. Almost nobody saw the gorilla. You know, hundreds of people in the audience. But then he shows the video again. Sure enough, you know, they're playing ping pong, and a gorilla walks on stage, looks around, walks behind the ping pong table, walks off the other end altogether, and you don't see him. You know, you just don't see him. So he was saying that's how, you know, you just, it's actually, in psychology, it's called selective attention. But he was saying, this is how I can fool you. We can, you know, you get the eye to look one place, and then everything else can go on that you don't see. And there's a lot going on that we don't see. I'm going to come back to that point, how that part of it works. So then I was thinking about the Hudson River. I think Sheila said yesterday, you know, you could spend some time looking at the Hudson River. So, you know, there is no Hudson River. There's no such thing as the Hudson River. Now, there's something happening out there. The Lenape, who used to live in this area, the Native Americans, they called it Muhiakantuk. Which means the river that flows both ways. And I think it's very interesting how they're using names and how we use names, right? It's not actually a name. I'm going to come back to that idea over and over in my teaching with you. The No Hudson River and Muhiakantuk, which is what they called it, is not a name either. It's just the river that flows both ways. But you think of it as a name. And the Iroquois called it Mahikunituk, which meant just the Great Mohegan. And the Dutch called it the Rio de Montaigne and the North River. But that's just the names altogether. And so that's just the name part of it. But there actually is no river out there at all. I mean, there's just stuff happening out there. And we take a picture of it in our mind, a snapshot of it in our mind, freeze it, and say, okay, this is the river. And these are its banks, but the banks are constantly changing. Every single second, the banks are not the same as they were a second before or an instant before. And then you think of it as a river, but it's actually the Atlantic Ocean, too, because the Atlantic Ocean, the tide from the Atlantic Ocean and water from the Atlantic Ocean is coming all the way down from New York, which is whatever, 60 miles south of here, and going another 60 miles north of here, up the river. So it's the river that flows both ways. It looks like there's a river going down there, but actually it's not just that river and the Atlantic Ocean. So you're looking at the Atlantic Ocean too. But the Atlantic Ocean's not the Atlantic Ocean either. And the water, there's just water, and sometimes that water is flowing out there, and sometimes it's in you, and sometimes it's in me, and sometimes it's in the sky, in clouds, and sometimes it's in China. So where's the boundary? Like it's so, in some ways, artificial and arbitrary to set a boundary. It's very convenient. Relative reality helps us with certain things. Ajahn Sumedho, and by relative reality, basically, I'm starting to talk about conceptual thinking. And Ajahn Sumedho said, conceptual thinking is really good. Like, it's good for counting, and getting something out of the refrigerator. And then sort of as you get past there, mostly your mind lies to you. The thinking mind is mostly lying the rest of the time, thinking that there are things like the Hudson River when there's no Hudson River. And not only there's no Hudson River, there's no me and there's no you. There's just stuff unfolding. There's just stuff unfolding. So I'm going to talk about how that illusion happens, basically. How the illusion of me and you happens, and I want to talk about it from the point of view of presenting it in such a way that it actually would be helpful to us in our practice. Because I can really get off on the theoretical side of it, and a lot of my talks get pretty analytical, and this one in some ways will get analytical because we're going to start to dissect the process and look at this and look at this and look at that. And when I reflect on that, I think about all the components I'm going to talk about tonight, and I try to place them in the symbol system of Jewish mysticism and where it fits into which of the worlds in the Yud, in the Hey, in the Vav, in the Hey. And I am going to come back to that. That is stuff I like talking about. I think it's really relevant to the practice we're doing here. I just more or less finished writing a book, which is a Jewish theology for mindfulness meditation, a completely theological approach to what we're doing, even though this practice was taught in a completely not theological context. The Buddha who came up with mindfulness meditation chose not to speak about the divine in that way. I mean, I think the God he wasn't speaking about is not the God I'm speaking about either, but he never said there was no God. He just said God is one of the great imponderables. And so if you spend any time thinking about God, it's just as vexing to the mind. So I spend a lot of time thinking about God, but not the God he was talking about, I think, which is the God you can't say anything about, the ineffable. We'll come back to that, perhaps. But more than that, I spend time reflecting on what can I know directly through this practice, and then how does that fit into what some people have said is the divine, including what Jewish mystics have said. But I'll do more of that on Thursday night and really try to... I think there's a way to fit the whole practice we're doing into Genesis and Exodus using biblical verses. So tonight I want to focus more on what we can do with this practice, what you need to know to support your practice, even in general with mindfulness, and specifically here on the retreat as we start to work through moment by moment. And what we've already said is to pay attention moment by moment. We want to pay attention moment by moment. And one of the main things we're going to be paying attention to is what happens in our minds. And now I'm going to have to say a little bit about what is a mind. What is a mind and what is mindfulness? But I want to point out enough, I want to give enough, make enough points about what to pay attention to. Because if we pay attention moment by moment, in any given moment, we don't see the process of mind. I think what I want to talk about is the process of mind. And so to understand the process of mind, you have to pay attention over successive moments, and you have to look at a number of things. So I want to point out sort of the process, and I want to point out what are the things I think we should look at. And this is a teaching that when you get your reading assignments, and in the Buddhist world, there's a teaching that's sometimes referred to as the aggregates, the teaching of the five aggregates. Or in Pali and Sanskrit, this is the skandhas, the five skandhas or the five khandhas. And you'll have, we're going to assign you some readings about it. It's a teaching that when I heard it, it was really, really important to me. And it is still like the underpinning of how I, when I'm paying attention moment by moment and thinking about what's happening and not lost, it seems like, oh, this is what's happening. It's pretty clear how this all unfolds. And so this teaching really elucidated it for me. I'm going to teach it in the context of small mind. I'm calling it small mind, which is language, which is Jewish language, superimposed on the Buddhist teaching. And that language, small mind, mohin de katnut, or small mind, in distinction to large mind, mohin de gadlut. These are concepts that come out of Jewish mysticism. And those concepts have some very specific teachings that are connected to them, mostly which I don't know what those teachings are in the strict Jewish mystical sense. But I know I've been working with is how to, you know, what do those terms seem to mean in the sense of moment-by-moment presence, small mind and big mind. And that I feel like I have a really good sense of from paying attention. And even in talking about that, what's important for me, which I think I'll keep coming back to over and over, I already did in some of my instructions this morning in the meditation, is to really be careful about the biases that language already insert there. So I'm going to talk about individual things to pay attention to in the context, and I want you to know that I more or less believe the statement, all separation is untrue. All separation is untrue. So even in using these concepts about different aspects of reality, I already have to move into concepts to do that, I have to use concepts to talk to you. Maybe if I could show you what was going on in my mind somehow, without having to use words, you could just all get it or something. But that's what you're going to do, and you're going to just watch it in your mind. And essentially, you get it not conceptually. You get it from paying attention, and then from outside, you see how the concepts work. So even when I say small mind and big mind, there is no small mind, there is no big mind in an absolute sense. But it's relatively helpful to think about some of these things in that way. To the extent that it's helpful, it's still important to remember that they coexist. So even if I talk about small mind and big mind, they are part of a whole that works together. The only reason we can pay attention to small mind and see what's happening in small mind is because big mind is what's paying attention to small mind. So you can't even do this without both of them. And some of what I'm going to highlight is what Sheila already referred. Some of what I'm going to highlight in terms of the actual specifics of what to pay attention to is were covered partly in what Sheila mentioned already yesterday in talking about the four foundations of mindfulness. You know, different arena. Four foundations of mindfulness are different things to pay attention to. So, in the use of this concept of small mind, who we are, the sense that we have of an identity, including the words me, you know, and including then the specifics about what things we identify with, our gender, race, Jewish, meditator, anything you might have an identity around. These are all, in my sense, manifestations of small mind. These are all like the story of the Hudson River. It seems to me that just like in the Hudson River example, you know, when we watch a movie, you probably all know this about motion pictures, nothing's moving in a movie. If you see a movie on a screen, it's just a series of individual still shots. Every single frame is an individual still shot. And if they move quickly enough, they fool the mind into believing that something is actually moving in some sort of continuous fashion. So when we look at the individual things that this way of looking offers us, that's what we'll see. We'll see that there's this experience, and there's this experience, and there's this experience, and then there's a story the mind makes up about that experience to make it into a flowing movie, and it creates a sense of identity out of non-identity moments. So the small sense of self is the product of small, the sense of self is a product of small mind. That's the major thing I want to look at. So we'll look at individual pieces, but the major reason we're doing that is to see that what small mind creates is the story of me, and which seems to be a continuous flowing thing. The other thing that's sort of almost hand in hand with that is that by doing that, we'll also see that there's not only not a me, but there's nothing permanent. That's one of the things that's sort of simple to see as soon as we start paying attention. There's just things unfolding moment by moment, and none of them are permanent. This one comes, then it goes, and the next one comes, and it goes, just like the in-breath, just like the out-breath. It's really nice to breathe in, you get all this oxygen, but it has to stop pretty quickly. That's one of the beautiful things about paying attention to the breath. So when I think about the components I want us to think about that are components of big mind that allow us to do this practice of delineating what small mind is and see how small mind is operating, those pieces I want to talk about primarily as awareness. There's a function called awareness. There's an aspect of mind and a function of the process of mind that I would call the process of loving attention, that our minds can pay. One aspect of the awareness aspect of mind is capable, through the loving awareness function of mind, to pay attention to this whole illusion that arises in the small mind. But big mind is loving attention, the awareness that allows that to connect to experience, and then the wisdom. I think wisdom is also an aspect of mohin de gadlut, of large mind. There's a tremendous wisdom that arises when, because of the faculty of awareness and because of paying attention, when we see how small mind operates, we actually can figure it out. It's like, oh, this is, and so wisdom arises. So wisdom, loving attention, awareness, these are all the aspects of large mind. Of mohin de gadlut. Okay, I'm out of time. one of the things I thought about in giving this talk was I've talked about this material, I don't know, 60 or 70 times. So I sort of think about coming into this like, I don't really need notes to do this. But then when you realize, because I could talk about it forever. And that's why I needed some notes, because I could talk about it forever. To talk about it for 45 minutes is really, wow, okay. So, small mind, mohin de katnut. So, in the teaching of the five skandhas, small mind is made up of five, there are five things happening. You're going to have readings and all that. You're certainly welcome to take notes, but it's pretty straightforward. You'll remember what to pay attention to, and we're going to incorporate this in the instructions anyways, most of what I'm sharing. But small mind is made up of five phenomena. So, and one of them is generally classified as body. And we have, there is something physical happening. So I'm not saying there is no water. I'm not saying that nothing's happening on the physical plane, although mostly we don't really see what it is, but there is something happening on the physical plane. The boundaries of it aren't as clear as it seems. You know, atoms are sharing electrons, so the separateness isn't even quite what it appeared. But there is, nevertheless, there is. We're starting out with the sense that there is an extant physical world without fully knowing what that world is. And that's one function that makes up what happens in the small sense of mind. And then there are four mental factors. So there's one physical factor and four mental factors. So the four mental factors are going to be called vedana, or feeling tone, which is the quality of being able to recognize what's happening in the physical realm as being either pleasant or unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. There's perception, which I'm going to come back to, which is where our conceptualizing mind starts to layer in. The conceptualizing function of the human, especially of human beings' minds, comes in, which is the labeling of things, the identifying of things. I'll talk a little bit more about all these things. There is something I'm going to call volitional fabricating. The mind comes up with thoughts, and those thoughts arise out of having a volition, meaning a will for something to happen. And along with that will, mental objects called thoughts and ideas, using concepts, comes together that create a plan of action. That's all volitional fabricating. And all of those things are directly knowable because of a factor called consciousness. So we have bodily stuff, and there's consciousness of bodily stuff. There's pleasant or unpleasant reality, and there's consciousness of that pleasant or unpleasant reality. There's perceptions, and then there's consciousness of perceptions. You can know that you're perceiving this or perceiving that. You hear this and you think, bell. And you know that you have the concept of a bell. And you know that you're hearing. And you could know instantly, if you check it out, whether that hearing is pleasant or unpleasant. And you can be conscious of that fact as well. So there's consciousness of that. And then you can make up a plan. So when you hear the bell, I think I'll stand up now and go get lunch. That's one example of a volitional fabrication. But you can also be conscious of the fact that I'm thinking about going to have lunch right now. So consciousness touches into all of those four other things. And I'm going to come back to all of that. I wanted to say a little bit about awareness and consciousness. So, in the teaching of the five aggregates that come out of the mindfulness tradition, consciousness is usually talked about as one of those aggregates, one of those things that makes up this small sense of self, or small mind, although the Buddha didn't use the word small mind, but I think it fits really well in the Jewish sense of what small mind and big mind are. And then my friend Brian was telling me that there are some places where consciousness is dealt with slightly differently than that. But the important point I want to make at this moment in talking about the aggregates, the skandhas, these five things, is that these are all considered to be impermanent things that arise and pass, These are conditioned phenomena. They're all conditioned phenomena. And they depend on conditions, and they depend on conditions and causes coming together, and then they arise for a while, and then they pass out of being, including consciousness, according to this teaching. When I use the word awareness, I mean something other than consciousness. I'm making a distinction between consciousness and awareness. I'll tell you what the distinction I make is, but this is fairly arbitrary and it's not arbitrary from my point of view, but it's many people have different definitions for these things, and but the way I'm working with it, I think of awareness and consciousness as different. There's a huge sea change going on in the meditation world. And it relates a little bit, I think, to your question that you asked this morning about concentration. Sort of, you made a reference to concentration. Like when I started, I just did a month-long retreat at Spirit Rock, which is where I really learned this practice. You know, 18 years ago, 19 years ago, I did quite a number of retreats at Spirit Rock. I probably hadn't sat there as a student for about 8 years. And so I just did a month-long silent retreat in February. Sheila was there for a month in silence in March, and so was Sylvia. First time I sat there for 2 weeks as part of that retreat, Sylvia was on the teaching staff. But when I went there, they really wanted us to work really hard. This is what I remember from the early years, especially. And they really were pushing us to concentrate and to bring the attention to one-pointed focus and concentration practice and the various absorptive states that can happen out of that. And you're going to read about all these things over the time together. And I pulled back from that concentration practice after my first 6 or 7 years of practice, moved more towards open awareness. When I did this retreat in England, the teacher I sat with there, Ajahn Sumedho, talked only about awareness. In essence, I would say he made fun of concentration practices. And he didn't teach them. I mean, it is a 12-day retreat. And it's not that he had done them for 20 or 30 years very seriously. So I'm not suggesting you not use concentration practices. But he was talking about awareness. All he was talking about is awareness. He never gave a single instruction to pay attention to anything in particular. He just said, just notice what's happening now. Now it's like this. Now it's like this. Now it's like this. He called that practice awareness. And when I got to Spirit Rock in February, all the same teachers who had been teaching me the other things, they all talked about awareness. Everybody was teaching awareness. But what I realized that by about the third day is they all meant something, even they all meant something different by it. Now, each one of them is using the term. It's the hot term, sort of. And people are practicing open awareness. They teach how to practice open awareness differently, and they mean something. They even all mean something different by awareness. So this is what I mean by awareness is, I think of awareness as that phenomena which has the property of knowingness. It knows what's arising. It knows if this is arising in consciousness. So in that sense, I'm using consciousness as the consciousness directed to the particular senses. We have particular senses: hearing, tasting, touching, seeing, and smelling, and one more, which I'll get to very quickly. So we have all these different senses, and when a sense object like sound waves strike a sense door, which happens to be the eardrum, that's the physical piece. Then the way I learned it is that the way I experience it is that hearing consciousness arises. So that's happening, but the mental factor of it is that hearing consciousness is arising. So I'm using consciousness to talk about the particular experiences of knowing that are connected to particular physical phenomena. So seeing consciousness, you could just call it seeing. There's visual object, and then there's something called seeing. And you have to be the visual object. If a person was dead, they still would have eardrums. The sound object would still strike the eardrum. The eardrum would still vibrate. But without living consciousness, there'd be no hearing happening. But the way I learned it, that consciousness, you could call it hearing consciousness, or you could just call it hearing. That's a conditioned phenomenon, because when that sound disappears, when it stops vibrating, the hearing disappears. So that consciousness is an arising and passing phenomenon. The awareness, that in awareness, when hearing arises, it's known. And when it passes, awareness, now this is the way I learned it from Ajahn Sumedho, but he used awareness and consciousness synonymously. Sometimes he'd call it awareness, sometimes he'd call it consciousness. So he wasn't quite making the distinction, but he was making a distinction to say that awareness, and sometimes he would call it consciousness, he was making a statement that awareness is not really of the conditioned realm. It's more like the sky, in which clouds arise and pass. So clouds arise and pass in the sky, and the sky is not changed by the cloud. It was there before the cloud, and it's there after the cloud, and not changed by the cloud. And he and many of the Tibetan teachers talk about it this way, and maybe we'll do a guided practice later this week, or if not this week, another on one of our other retreats where I'll try to take you into that place as a guided way to practice like that. It's called Big Sky Meditation. A number of you have done it with me. So I think of awareness that way, and Ajahn Sumedho would refer to it that way, that awareness is a taste of the unconditioned. And it's somewhat, it almost fudges. It's not quite the conditioned realm. It's not quite the unconditioned realm. There's nothing you can say about the unconditioned realm. That's the ineffable. But the main Buddhist sutta that Ajahn Sumedho talked about was a sutta that goes like this. Because there is the unborn, the uncreated, the unformed, the unconditioned, it's possible to wake up here in the realm of the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned. So you can't say anything about what that stuff is, except it's not. It's not this, it's not that, it's not this, it's not that. That's our exact language for Ein Sof. You can't say anything about Ein Sof. It's just not Sof. It's just not bounded. You know, Maimonides, the great Jewish philosophers, all say you can't say anything about that which is outside this plane of reality. The Jewish mystics say that too, but this plane of reality is also God. So you can say a lot about this plane of reality. So that's the immanent God that I'll talk about in theology. And so I think of awareness as being in that place in the Jewish mystical system. It takes the same place in Atzilut, I'd put it. If that doesn't mean anything to you now, it will at some point. But there's a place where it is a taste of the unconditioned, I think. And Ajahn Sumedho used to say, like, awareness is never the object of awareness. But anything that can be known, something is doing the knowing. But you can never have but that which is doing the knowing can never be the object of awareness. Because if it was, then it would be some transitory phenomena, and something would be knowing that, and then that would be the place that's not the conditioned. And that's what, because there is the unborn, the uncreated, the unformed, the unconditioned, that's why we can wake up in this realm. That's basically the same teaching as there's big mind. That's why we can see what small mind is. If we couldn't see what small mind is, we would be stuck in it forever. And we would just be in a loop of conditioned reality with no free will and no possibility of waking up out of it. But because there's something bigger than it, so to speak, although language is a problem, something that's not that, that's why it's possible to wake up. And I think loving attention is the bridge that allows us to access what's happening in small mind and bring it into awareness. And then it can be understood. And so the wisdom is also, that manifests also outside of the conditioned phenomena, in essence. It's wisdom, I wouldn't say it's outside conditioned phenomena, but it's wisdom about conditioned phenomena. And as the conditioned phenomena disappear, that wisdom arises and passes. So it's somewhat conditioned. But the wisdom is also known in awareness. I'm hoping these things mean something to you. This is what, and I try to pay attention to it moment by moment. So now if we come back to the skandhas themselves, this is what you could actually pay attention to moment by moment. So I'm suggesting you start by paying attention to the body, because that's the first foundation of mindfulness. It's the core of these five skandhas. There is body. Body is a conceptual label on top of it, but you don't need the concept to know the body. You can directly pay attention to this body without any labels. And can directly know sensations without any labels. Because each of those sense doors that are in this body can has consciousness that arises with it. So seeing can happen when a visual object strikes the eye. You don't need any concepts for that. When seeing is happening, you don't have to call it seeing, but it's still happening and it's still knowable without concepts. We all grew up learning there were five such sense doors, seeing, touching, tasting, hearing, and smelling. But when this teaching came over from the East, it came with, and this is probably the most important thing I'm going to say tonight, with everything else I just said, there's two really important things. This is going to be one of them, is that the teaching came over with six sense doors and six kinds of mental objects, seeing, touching, tasting, hearing, and smelling, and with the eye, the nose, the ear, the sense organs of touch, the tongue. But then there's another set of sensory objects called mental objects. And mental objects are known by the sense organ for mental objects, which is the brain. So a thought can arise. It's a, I would call it an essence on the mental edge of a physical sensation. Probably will decode the whole biochemistry of it at some point. A thought arises, and that thought is known. And it's just another object, just like all the, just like sound is an object. Hearing is a hearing of audio objects. So there are mental objects called thoughts, and that's a critical. That was probably the most important thing when I practiced moment by moment, to realize that I'm not my thoughts. Just like I'm not a sound, I don't identify the sound as me. That's me ringing. You know, no, it's not me. It's not me thinking either. Me is a concept that can be known in awareness by this thinking brain. And me is a concept that can get layered on top of other mental objects and on top of physical experiences. But I think about them all as mental objects that are known in awareness through thinking consciousness, you know, through the consciousness of mental objects. So that's, that's one of the key points. Then, so that's two of the five things. So there's physical objects, and there's the knowing of physical objects that we're calling consciousness. Seeing consciousness, hearing consciousness, thinking consciousness, right? You can think a thought, and you know, I'm thinking about this now. Lots of times when we're thinking thoughts, we don't know we're thinking. The witness disappears. But we all can directly experience, sometimes we do know we're thinking something. Maybe we'll do that as an exercise in case that doesn't ring true to you. But you could just try it on yourself, by yourself sometimes. Just think something and pay attention while you're thinking and see if you can't know that you're thinking. It's pretty easy to do. So when those objects arise in the mind, and every single sensory experience, including the thoughts, including the mental objects, when they're known in this nervous system, which is a part of the, which one of the functions of mind, when they're known, there is a phenomena that classifies those known mental objects as either pleasant or unpleasant. It's a brain function, a mind function. And sometimes there are sensations that are neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So I try not to use the word neutral. So some sensations are pleasant, some are unpleasant, some are neither pleasant nor unpleasant. You see, I try to be very careful about language because it's so misleading. So this is the next most important thing that you probably all know. You do all know, but so just remember that mental object is one more sensation. The other really important thing to remember from this talk is that when sensations are pleasant, that kicks off a whole chain in the mind, and it's the key thing to notice if you really want to understand what's going on in your mind, and how and why the mental things in your mind and the thoughts you have and the beliefs and the views and the opinions, including the sense of self, you want to understand that. The clearest thing is that when something is pleasant, it kicks the whole process of mind into gear to try to hold on to it, to get more of it. That's pleasant. I start thinking about it being pleasant. I start thinking about how to get more of that pleasant thing. And when something is unpleasant, you start thinking about it enlists the whole mental apparatus, and which then enlists the physical apparatus to get rid of the unpleasant thing and to never have it again and to figure out, you know, planning from now until Olam Haba, never to have that again, you know. And both of those things, whether you're trying to hold on to something or get rid of something, narrows down the attention, and you're no longer paying attention to what's happening in the present moment. You're lost in mental proliferation or volitional fabricating, which we'll get to briefly, and all driven by the fact that things are pleasant or unpleasant. And that's going to be the second foundation of mindfulness. We'll have specific instructions for noticing that. Then come the things that are unique. I don't want to strike that. Then come the things that are really a feature of human beings. I don't know if they're a feature of any creatures other than human beings. I don't know how the minds of non-human beings work. But for sure the minds of human beings are predominantly caught up in conceptualizing. Thinking, discursive thought, telling stories, but those thoughts are all supported by words and concepts. And so we've talked about three foundations so far: pleasant, unpleasant, or vedana, it's called, bodily sensations, consciousness. So this, the fourth thing that I already mentioned once, is called perception. And perception is when we layer human concepts on top of an experience to identify it. So we look at an object, and totally out of conditioning and a skillful means and convenience, we decide that things are certain things, are called certain things. So we call this a bell. But it's just atoms. It's just atoms of a certain kind of alloy. And we choose, and if, when they're in this shape, we might choose to call it a bell. You know, and then sometimes the teachers will get funny and do things, you know, oh, no, it's a hat, you know. But the point is, it's just a concept that gets layered on top of an experience. And the problem with concepts the reality of concepts is they're conditioned. They're not intrinsically a part of something, but we take them on as complete reality, our concepts. And sometimes they're erroneous altogether. And the way the mind works, they tend to make meaning out of very, they take little bits of information and make big, and make inferences and stories out of those bits of information. So they're habituated and they're patterned, and partly because of that, they can often be misleading. They make us have a vision of reality that is not reality. So, for example, I just like this example. When you sing, if I sing the notes dun 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 dun, so your mind hears that, right? Like the way the nervous system works and the neural patterns works is that. Even if that sound doesn't come next, the mind interprets it must be there. And unless you're actually paying attention at the moment I do an exercise like that, which probably you were because you're all paying attention, a little bit down the road, if you don't know that that sound didn't happen, after the fact, the mind can't distinguish whether it actually heard that sound or not. It's every bit as real as if it actually happened. But it's not real in the sense that I think we use the word. That you probably all know, I didn't make that last note. But your mind heard it. And most of what you see and hear is patterned just like that. You see, if you look out and see a couple of yards and go, oh, the Hudson River. You know, it just, or you look up in the sky and you see these seven stars, you go, there's the Big Dipper. It's just out of seven little points. There's no Big Dipper up there. But it's really hard to look up there and not see the Big Dipper if those stars happen to be out. So, but just multiply that by as much as you could imagine, you know, infinitely. And that's what we're doing moment by moment by moment. And finally, all of that apparatus gets moved into what's called volitional fabricating. So the volition part is the part where there's an intention. And that intention, by and large, is being driven by what was noticed by the determination of pleasant or unpleasant. So most of the time, the intention in the mind that then creates concepts and statements and views is all driven by an intention to get the pleasant stuff or to get rid of the unpleasant stuff. Vast mental patterns and thoughts get created. Those thoughts have direction in them, comments in them, stories in them, and then that's the world we live in. We more or less live inside the reality of those, the apparent reality of that, of those volitional fabrications. And this is what you can look at moment by moment by moment in your experience and see how these stories are getting layered on top of experience. And if you pay attention in successive moments and you know what to pay attention to, you can see it happening. I'll just give one example and then close for tonight. So when I was on retreat at Spirit Rock, this was years ago, but this happens all the time, and I was sitting in the hall and things were glorious. The mind was calm and steady, it was expansive, everything was beautiful. I got up, started walking to the dining room for lunch, and some unpleasant sensation. I felt, I was paying attention because I was a couple weeks into a retreat. I'm walking, all of a sudden this unpleasant sensation starts arising somewhere in here, and instantly I heard my mind say, I noticed this, and my mind said, I must be doing something wrong. Now, I was paying attention, so the whole thing was transparent in the sense that I noticed this happening, okay, unpleasant sensation, I must be doing something wrong. Wait a minute. It was instantly clear. First of all, it went right away from I feel bad to I am bad. Right? Nobody was doing anything wrong. Things just changed. The situation changed. You can't be in a body and not have things change. Pleasant things fade away, unpleasant things come. That comes and goes all the time. So something changed. Nobody did anything. I didn't do anything. The truth is, there was no I. It was all extra. It was very obvious. I didn't do anything, and I didn't do anything wrong, and I didn't need to have a sense of an identity of somebody who I'm somebody who does something wrong, and that's why I'm suffering from this unpleasant thing. So there was no truth to that. But it was a sneaky way that my mind was trying to come up with some plan to go back and get, you know, I must be doing something wrong, I'll figure it out, I'll start doing that other stuff again, then I'll have that pleasant feeling. It was all just scheming to try to get that pleasant stuff. But in the meantime, it has to create a bad guy to do that, it has to create somebody doing something wrong. And most of the time we don't notice that. And that happens. The bad person is, you know, I'm the bad person walking down the road trying to figure out what I'm doing wrong with my life. And it's just all just going on and automatic. But when it's seen, so this is the value of big mind, when it's seen, it was transparent. It was obviously, it worked just the way they said it would work. So it became a realization of the teaching. There's a teaching, probably most of what I'm saying is makes sense to you. But in your practice, you get to practice it, and then it becomes realized. Joanna taught me to use that word. You know, it's actually real. Realize means, oh, this is really how it works. I mean, I know it's how it works, but wow, it really works that way. So because I was in this place of paying loving attention moment by moment to my experience, that became a moment. Instead of becoming a moment of I'm a bad guy, it was a moment of great compassion. Oh, look how easy it is for human beings to get tripped up. Look how easy it might be for me to get tripped up. But I didn't get tripped up. And that's what it's like to be in big mind. Loving attention is manifesting. Wisdom, because there was a wisdom piece there. It's like, oh, look what just happened. And it went like that. You know, that's unskillful. Don't have to go there. I'm not fooled by it. So that's the potential of paying loving attention, moving into big mind. So let's sit and let that sort of sink in. And then don't spend any time thinking about it, really. You don't need to think about these concepts. Just start practicing, paying attention to your body, noticing things are pleasant or unpleasant, notice mental things happening in the mind. Let's just sit for a minute. So thank you for your kind attention. And this is a line I borrowed from Ajahn Sumedho, but I really like it. So I offered these teachings for your reflection, not as an alternative belief system to believe in. These are for you to reflect upon, not by thinking about them, but by moment, checking out, is this how it works? Is this what your experience of life is like? So thank you for listening.